Until he died of AIDS at the age of 37, David Wojnarowicz was one of the leading figures in the downtown art scene throughout the 1980s. Now, 20 years after his death, Cynthia Carr has written a biography of the artist called Fire in the Belly, The Life and Times of David Wojnarowicz, which is a portrait not only of his life, but also the rise and decline of the East Village as an art mecca and of the AIDS crisis in New York City. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased that it brings Cynthia Carr to our show today. Hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Now, you write that you knew David personally and that he told you many of the stories about his life that appear in the book. Under what circumstances did you meet him? When you were writing under the name C. Carr for the Village Voice?
I knew him by then. I'd met him in 1982 before I was writing for The Voice and before he had ever shown in a gallery. I was working at that point as a paste-up person, which younger people won't even know what that is, but I was at Art Forum working there with the art director pasting up the pages, and David came in one night late and because he knew the art director and he wanted to borrow some money. And at that point, I knew that he was the guy doing the stencils on various walls in the East Village and elsewhere. And but I didn't know much else about him, but he kind of made an impression. He was like a force, you know, and he and his friend Keith discussed some things, and then he left quickly. But after that, I would meet him on the street sometimes, and we'd talk. But then I met him, I knew him best when he got in trouble with the religious right in 1990. I did a cover piece for the Village Voice about his life, and at that point I did three interviews with him about his life story.
Well, that was pretty late in his life. He died only a year later.
Yeah, he died in 92. He died, but he had already been diagnosed.
But he was already kind of famous within the New York art scene.
Yes.
The chapters about his early life include some contradictory statements. Was there a Rashomon aspect to the process of writing this book?
Well, yes. For example, he grew up with an abusive alcoholic father in New Jersey, and always said that he then moved to New York when he was 9, but he didn't. But I think he really believed that he was 9. And I found that in interviewing his brother, his sister, the stepmother, the step-siblings, no one could remember when that transition happened from New Jersey into Manhattan when he moved in with his mother.
And everybody seems to have a different way, memory of the stories,
right.
The various stories here.
Right. Right. Everyone remembered it slightly differently, but to me it's just evidence of trauma.
The only thing that they seem to agree on is that the family was dysfunctional.
Yes. Yes, very dysfunctional.
When was it apparent that David was gay? How early?
He didn't really he had started hustling when he was a teenager, but I think it's true sometimes with hustlers, they don't really think of themselves as gay, and I don't think he did exactly, although he did find some shelter at the Gay Activist Alliance Firehouse when it was in Soho. But he came out actually when he was about 22.
The reason I ask is sometimes that's also a cause of tension within a family.
Yeah, I don't know that it did. I mean, his mother didn't seem to mind that he was gay. His sister was completely accepting of his brother. I don't think that bothered them.
And when his parents divorced, did he wind up with one or the other?
Well, that happened when he was 2, and the mother actually got custody, but she put them in some kind of boarding house over in Red Hook, and the father kidnapped them from that place and took them to Michigan. And she didn't seem to try to get them back. I mean, that's one of the things none of them can agree on. Did she try to find us or didn't she? And so he ended up with his father.
Well, you said that he claimed to become a hustler at a young age, living on the streets of New York and working Times Square?
Well, his mother lived very near Times Square. She was in Hell's Kitchen. And I think he started hustling, maybe he was 14 or 15, but he wasn't living on the street then. He would run away. Sometimes he would run away for periods of time. And he actually ended up on the streets when he was 17.
How did he get out of that life?
Well, I think he had been in a place for the young kids. The word escapes my mind, but
Not reform school.
No. Like a halfway house or something like that. He was in a halfway house. And he was out on the street with a friend and I think realized that he wasn't going anywhere. And he sort of begged the halfway house to take him back.
But he also began writing fairly early on in his life. So he didn't get much education, but he seemed to have those kinds of artistic impulses from the start.
Yeah, he was very self-directed and also, of course, self-educated. He graduated near the bottom of his class at the High School of Music and Art, and it took him till he was 19 to get that degree, even though he had skipped a grade in school. And so he should have graduated by the time he was even 16. This is the part that I found very fascinating when I did my research. He hid this part of his life where he became a poet. You know, after he got off the streets and was living with friends on the Upper West Side, he was doing poetry and editing a literary magazine.
But since he went to music and art, that would suggest that he always had an interest in visual arts.
Yes, yeah. And even his stepmother would say that when he was little, when the other older kids were in school, she could give him a paper and pencil and he would occupy himself for hours drawing.
But, okay, so he starts writing, and that's also a part of the transition out of the earlier life. When did he begin painting in the abandoned warehouses on the piers in Manhattan's West Side?
I think he started as early as 1981. Part of what I found in this book is, or what I talk about here, is the way he actually taught himself how to be an artist. And sometimes it was through artist friends. And he was painting there quite a bit with another artist named Luis Frangella. And I think Luis showed him some, you know, technical things about how to paint. And because his early drawings look very different from what his work ended up looking like. You know, they're sort of cartoony, very sort of fine line ink drawings. And that really changed, but he had to figure out how to do that.
When you paint on the walls of abandoned warehouses, it's unlikely that the work is going to not going to be destroyed.
Right.
How much
right.
of that work still is available?
None of it. It's all gone. And I don't know. He seemed to. I know he knew that, and he seemed to even enjoy that part of it. And then, in a way, that gave him freedom. You know, he could experiment and play around, and it wasn't going to go into a gallery, and wasn't going to go to a museum. It was going to be destroyed, and I think he sort of enjoyed that.
It's the opposite of how so many art students work. Teachers have to constantly remind them that they're not going to create a masterpiece in their first years of painting or sculpting or whatever they're doing.
Right.
He also, you write, had a wonderful mentor, Peter Hujar, the photographer.
Yes. Yeah, Peter was, the most important person in his life, I think, changed his life. And Peter's the one who encouraged him to become a visual artist. And it's funny, when you look at David's body of work, the first pieces he did that become part of that body of work are the Rambeau in New York photo series and the a collage called Untitled Genet. But he didn't draw any of that. It was, you know, collage work and photo work. And then Peter is the one who said, no, you can be a visual artist. And all of David's early work is all, first of all, made from stencils, but they all incorporate an image of Hujar.
What was that Rambeau series like?
He made a mask of Rambeau from the very famous, I think, only photo of Rambeau, the portrait. And he got a brief job at an ad agency, and they taught him how to work a stamp machine. So he enlarged that picture on the front of Illuminations and made a life-size mask out of it, and then got various friends to pose, you know, on the subway, on 42nd Street, at the piers, at Coney Island, all over New York, on the Bowery. He had some idea of making an entire story out of it, but I think stopped before he got that far.
My guest is Cynthia Carr, who's written a biography called Fire in the Belly, The Life and Times of David Vojnarovich. It is published by Bloomsbury. He began showing at the early East Village galleries like Civilian Warfare and Gracie Mansion. Why did that neighborhood become a center for art galleries in the 1980s? The spaces were relatively small, and Soho and Chelsea which, Chelsea came a little later, part of their appeal is that the spaces are so big.
Right, right. Well, the first gallery was fun, and I think that was the atmosphere in which this started. It was fun, and that was in a tiny space. And then Gracie started doing her shows in her apartment, and she called it the Lou Division. The work was actually displayed in her bathroom. And it was, again, in the spirit of let's have a party, let's have fun. And at the Civilian, which was a tiny storefront, I know David loved showing there because it really violated that idea of what a gallery should be, and he liked that aspect of it. And it started, you know, the East Village was sort of ripe because it was a cheap neighborhood, and people could get a storefront really cheaply. You know, landlords were overjoyed, in fact, when the old bodega suddenly turned into an art gallery. They thought that was great.
I remember Pat Hearn's gallery was on a street where there was a lot of garbage in the middle of the street.
Yes. Yeah, so she was sort of in the second wave of galleries there on Avenue B. She actually redesigned her entire space, and I remember thinking how odd it looked in the neighborhood because it was all gleaming.
But it was also a place that appealed to alternative kinds of artists like Basquiat and David.
Yeah.
It seems that very quickly the media began promoting these artists and then collectors began buying. Did David become successful right away?
He had some success with his first shows, yes, and in fact he was in the biennial by 85. He didn't start showing until I think his first show was 83, so that's fast.
But he didn't get along with one of the other stars of the time, Keith Haring. Why? Did they see each other as rivals?
Well, I think David, they had worked together. They had both been busboys at Danceteria, so they knew each other. And actually, David loved Keith's subway paintings, subway drawings. And I think he wanted to be friends with him, and Keith was very, you know, wouldn't let him near. And I think he resented that so much that he sort of turned on Keith.
But Kiki Smith became a friend.
Yes, yes. And this was before Kiki was famous and before David was famous. They just hit it off.
There's a lot of drug use in the East Village in those days. Was David part of that as well?
I would say he dabbled in it. He was never a junkie, though he did try heroin. And, you know, many of his friends were junkies. And one of the dealers at Civilian Warfare had a serious drug problem. And that was one of the things that led to the demise of that gallery. But David stopped finally because of Hujar, who said to him one day that David thought it was funny that his arm had turned green from shooting up, and he showed it to Hujar. And Peter said to him, if you keep doing that, don't ever come to my house again.
Now, you also, I mentioned earlier, document the beginnings of the AIDS crisis from the first reports of Kaposi's sarcoma in gay men to the founding of ACT UP. Were the artists in David's social circle especially affected by the illness?
It seems like it. I mean, he lost many friends.
When did he discover he was HIV positive?
I think he agreed to be tested finally. I think it was in 88, and found out that he did have AIDS.
And it affected his work.
Well, yes. He accelerated his process, thinking he might not be able to make more than one more show.
But he also sued the Reverend Donald Wildman and the American Family Association. What was that lawsuit about?
Well, that was when David had a retrospective at Illinois State University in 1990, and the Reverend Wildman went through the catalog and basically picked out all the genitals, things like that, and pasted them on a page and said, "This is what your tax dollars are paying for." Mailed it to media people, ministers all over the country. And David sued him, said that, you know, this misrepresents my work.
Mm-hmm. And what happened?
David won the case, but he was only awarded $1 in damages.
That's like the famous case of Whistler against what's his name, John? Now I'm losing it.
Oh.
Anyway, he won. He was awarded one penny. I guess.
Right.
There were those symbolic victories.
And David called me after he won it, and he said, I'm going to...
John Ruskin. Okay.
Oh, right. Okay. David said, I'll either get an ice cream cone or a condom, depending on my mood.
you write that you spent a lot of time with him during his illness. Why do you think he was willing to open up to you then?
I've never been sure, but I think maybe the fact that I'm calm, the fact that I didn't want anything, the fact that I was able to talk about death with him.
Do you think his reputation has grown since his death?
I think so. He had a really successful retrospective in 1999, you know, years after his death at the New Museum. It was very, I think it was the best attendance show they ever had. And then he was in the news again, of course, in 2010 with the controversy at the Smithsonian. And more people became aware of him then.
Do you think that he has had a lasting influence on artists?
I think so. His gallery did a show, in fact, about all the young artists who've been influenced by him. And, yeah.
Well, in addition to painting, he was a writer and filmmaker. He played in a band. He did art installations. And your title, Fire in the Belly, is the title of one of his films.
Yeah, just slightly. He called it A Fire in My Belly, and I'm calling it Fire in the Belly, but yes.
But do you think that his paintings are what he will be best remembered for?
I think this last work of where he began to combine his visual work and his writing in single pieces, you know, and his writing, I think, will last. Some of the best writing out there about the AIDS crisis.
When you were sitting with him when he was ill, were you already thinking about the possibility of writing a biography? Because it's being published pretty much 20 years to the day
after
he died.
Yeah. I wasn't thinking about a book then, but I did think about his obituary, I have to admit.
Well, this is a beautiful obituary. Thank you so much for being with us, Cynthia Carr. Her book, Fire in the Belly, The Life and Times of David Wojnarowicz, published by Bloomsbury. It's been
a pleasure. Thank you very much.